Our guest is an internationally renowned expert of space archaeology. Associate Professor Alice Gorman's made a career of tracking human-made items in the cosmos and their preservation as cultural heritage. She lays claim to the first archaeological fieldwork to ever take place outside of Earth, or that we know about. She co-directed a study on how astronauts interact with their habitat of the International Space Station in 2022. Professor Gorman's also vice chair of the Global Expert Group on Sustainable Lunar Activities and an expert member of the International Scientific Committee for Aerospace Heritage. She's contributed to international space policy and has authored a book on the topic Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, Archaeology in the Future. She's even had an asteroid named after her in recognition of her work. Alice Gorman is with us from Sydney. Welcome.
Good morning.
Much to discuss. You're an archaeologist with expertise in indigenous stone tool analysis, among other things. You have years of work in that field. When was it that you first saw the need to apply your skills, the archaeologist's skills, to space?
Well, this came about in a moment, oh gosh, it's a bit over 20 years ago, which is slightly scary to think about. So I've been working in Indigenous heritage for most of my career, I guess. And one day I was working on a big project in Queensland and just had one of those light bulb moments. So I came home from a hard day in the field. It was summer. It was really hot and humid. And I just wanted a cold beer. And I took my beer out onto the veranda and it was dark already. And I'm just looking at the stars. And I thought, well, it's not just stars and planets out there. There's actually all these human-made objects as well, all these satellites and spacecraft. And then I thought, and some of them are space junk. And pretty much that's what archaeologists do. We study the junk abandoned by people on Earth. And it just struck me, this is an archaeological record in space. And some of these bits of junk, as well as being, you know, open for scientific analysis, they might have cultural heritage value. And that was it, really. From that moment, I changed my whole career and started working on space instead of things on the Earth.
So was it TUI's or VB that's responsible for all this when you were having your wine down?
I was in Queensland. I suspect I was drinking a 4X mid-strength. I can't believe I remember that.
Very good. Look, it's interesting you raise this because some of us look up at that night sky and think, oh, is that a shooting star? And it's not, because they go so fast you can barely see them. I did actually have an experience with one once. And then you think, actually, no, that's just a satellite. And this is the thing. We can rue what humans do, or we can be curious about what humans do. And with what's happening in space, would you put yourself in the latter?
Oh, it's. I definitely find all of these objects so fascinating, and I think they've got a unique story to tell about human culture and technology. But, you know, we're kind of doing the same thing to space that we've done to Earth, and I find that very concerning, as I think most people do. So it's not just about studying these artifacts for me. It's also about understanding what exactly it is we've created out there so we can have a more informed basis for doing something about it.
Very good point, and we've noted in the introduction your contribution to just these discussions. But let's start with the curiosities, and then we'll talk about some of what we may need to address in time. I think you moved pretty quickly on this, quit your job, and where did you even begin in order to begin to analyse, identify, and record what was out there, Alice?
Well, you know, I've spent most of my career looking on the surface of the Earth, thinking about stone tools, thinking about European historic artefacts, and suddenly I've decided that I'm going to look at these, you know, very modern, very technological things. And one thing I realised was, you know, that this wasn't part of my archaeology degree. I had to kind of start from scratch and work out you know, what are spacecraft? What are they made out of? What kinds of decisions make them look the way they do? How do they function? Like, once you put them in space, at that stage, I'm sure, like many people, you kind of think, well, there's orbits out there. So you put something in orbit and it just sort of trundles around like clockwork. But in fact, space is a really complex environment, and none of those orbits are beautiful little mechanical predictable things. So all of these gravitational, space weather, environmental factors. So I had to learn all about that. I had to read the engineering and technical literature, and I'll be honest and say, if equations popped up in the paper, I did tend to kind of skip over those pages pretty quickly and to get to the conclusion. So it was quite a challenge just to get up to speed with all of that technical literature. And I suppose there were things that leapt out at me as being particularly interesting or significant, and I started looking at them to try and, you know, to use as a platform for building the other ideas around. So it took years, I guess, I would say. But now I can go to a space conference and be chatting to some aerospace engineer. They'll have no idea I'm an archaeologist unless I tell them, because I feel I have managed to master that technical literature. So I'm quite proud of myself for that, honestly.
I bet it took a while to be accepted in a way, and your knowledge and your contribution now, you'll have won them over. What is out there, I guess? We've talked about satellites. When it comes to space junk, or perhaps in some ways you would say space valuables, we've talked about satellites. We know there's bits of rockets that have been launched and aren't ever coming back. But what else is out there?
Well, you know, we just say space junk and tend to leave it at that. But if you break it down into categories, the oldest object that is currently in space is the US Vanguard 1 satellite, which was launched in 1958. And it goes all the way up to the things launched just earlier this month. So we have old rocket bodies, we have whole satellites, we have satellites that have broken up into little pieces. There's slag from solid rocket fuel. There's bits of, maybe there's still some bits of ice that were ejected from some of the early space stations. There's a couple of space stations up there still occupied. There are millions of tiny little particles or particulates. So there's that whole thing about, you know, a little fleck of paint that scratches the space shuttle window in the era when the space shuttle existed. So there are millions of those. Then you have another probably few million of sort of little pea-sized fragments. And then you have all kinds of bits of thermal blankets and broken solar panels and fragments from exploded rocket bodies. There's a whole range of stuff. But I guess for me, I'm really interested in analysing all of those classes of space junk, but it's really the old satellites that to me have some amazing stories to tell.
So do you visually track them? I think you've got so-called Moonwatch groups, volunteers. Do you visually track where, say, the Vanguard 1 is?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to do that myself, because there are a few organisations globally that take on that role of tracking where everything is. So if I wanted to find out where Vanguard 1 is, I can and look up one of those observatories or services and find out. And the useful thing that they do is when something is looking like it might re-enter Earth's atmosphere, you get a bit of notice. And then when it's verified that it has re-entered, which usually ends in things burning up, then you find out about that too. So I'm kind of watching what's still up there, what's coming back in, and kind of keeping track of the number of old satellites with historic or cultural significance that we've still got up there.
So have you got actual physical objects that have returned, or is it more monitoring things from a distance?
It's kind of remote archaeology. So there's a bit of a paradox, because one of the things that draws people to archaeology is that, you know, it's very physical. You go out in the field, you're often out in, you know, beautiful landscape and countryside. You're digging in the dirt, you're touching things, you're in the lab, you know, recording and cataloguing thousands of artifacts, each one of which you engage with physically. So it's kind of weird to suddenly go from that to using numbers that someone else records on a radar or something to interact with the objects. So when things re-enter the atmosphere, they usually burn up completely, except for some of the more robust components, often fuel tanks. And we don't have a huge number of them. So for me, it's all, you know, archaeologists these days use satellite data to look at the Earth and record terrestrial sites. But I'm actually looking up at the objects that do that. And it's kind of, so I have to imagine them, I suppose. Like, there's pictures and engineers, diagrams and all kinds of information, but I have to kind of use my imagination a bit to kind of really feel or see this bit of space junk.
That kind of is the archaeologist's role in a way, or perhaps the sociologists and the historians pick up where you leave off, because to me it's about societies, plural, stories, plural. It's where we were when. It's who was there and how they lived, right? And even though you can't touch some of these items, those stories can be told. Let's look at another one, like the Australis Oscar V, please.
Oh, this is one of my all-time favourites. This is a little satellite that was designed and built by a bunch of students and their mates at the University of Melbourne in the 1960s. And it was launched as a sort of a, it was negotiated free launch in the US by a US-based amateur radio ham organisation called AMSAT. And it's still up there. So it's a piece of space junk. And there's this little black box. I think its orbit is around about 900 kilometres, something like that. And what I love about it is that it's an amateur satellite. So this isn't a big corporation with a lot of money. This is a bunch of students who kind of begged and scraped resources together, got their friends who already had jobs to kind of sneak a little bit of material out of the lab. They were putting everything together on no budget and on the fly, and their satellite was hugely successful. So it engaged a whole bunch of volunteers around the world. It got some good scientific data, and now it's space junk. But to me, that's such an important story, because it shows that, you know, you don't have to be a big defence contractor. You don't have to be a university. Well, they were students, but, you know, you don't have to have a lot of money to actually get involved in space. So, and the students, you know, they're all mature people now, but they're still around. And just listening to them talk about their hopes and aspirations in the mid-60s for a little Australian satellite, just I find really fascinating.
In 1969, of course, Apollo 2 landed on the moon. That site is interesting, and it is a site. It's a site that may be revisited in the not-too-distant future. Where they set foot is what? An archaeological site, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we tend to think of things that are recent, although, you know, this is starting to get not so recent, you know, that can't be archaeology, it's not old enough. But all we really need is that physical evidence of humans engaging with the environment. And here we have this extraordinary place where humans set foot on another world for the first time. And, you know, processes, weather and geology on the moon kind of moves at a fairly slow pace. So we thought this would be safe for a long, long time. And suddenly now it's not safe. All of these people are planning missions to the moon. Someone is going to walk up to that site and walk over the footprints, or drive their fancy new moon buggy over all of the traces left by those first astronauts. And I guess the question we have now is, do we want this to happen? And, you know, maybe we do. Maybe everyone's fine with that. But when I talk to people, most of them are like, no, this is actually pretty significant as a heritage place, and maybe we should try and discourage people from walking all over it.
They need to take you on the mission, Alice, so that you can tell them where to park and how to treat the area with some respect. Of course,
I am ready to go, yes.
I bet you are. Of course, a flag got planted, and that is interesting as well. We'll move on in the moment to how space is getting and is likely to get more busy and who's going to put what up there. But flags, of course, we associate often with territorial claim. This all happened in the context of the space race and the geopolitics surrounding that. But again, it's another talking point, isn't it, about humans and their artifacts and what they mean.
You're so right. So that flag is obviously a hugely symbolic object, and we do understand it as that colonial, territorial, you know, claiming of territory. And when the US put that first flag up there, there's several, the message was that they were doing this on behalf of all humanity, but it's a national symbol. So how do we reconcile those two things? And people are generally kind of okay with this at the moment, but the US is going back to the moon. It's trying to control the narrative a bit, I guess. And this is the thing about symbols. Their meanings don't stay frozen in time. So it's quite possible at some point in the future those flags are going to have a new significance which may relate to claiming territory. So, you know, I don't want to be pessimistic about this, but I just think we should keep an eye on it.
In 2021, you were part of a small collective that wrote the first Declaration of the Rights of the Moon. What's in them?
This was a really interesting exercise, and we were very much inspired in doing this by previous examples of giving rights to natural features or natural bodies. And of course, New Zealand was a world pioneer in this, in giving rights to a river. So we were thinking, you know, all of these people are going to go back to the moon. There's kind of no agreed international regime about how you manage environmental values. In fact, a lot of people say, you know, the moon is a dead world. It has no environmental values. But I don't think that's a sustainable argument. So we kind of really wanted to change the dialogue a bit. We wanted to say, what if we look at the moon as an entity with its own ecological integrity that we have a moral responsibility towards? So how would that change our behaviour? So we drafted this. It's quite short. It's only a couple of pages, Declaration of the Rights of the Moon, I suppose, to kind of change the balance a bit, to counter this move where everybody thinks of the moon as only a mineral resource, something to mine and exploit for human purposes. We want to say, well, the moon has a right to exist as well.
Well, this goes further, doesn't it, into questions of weapons in space, mining in space, tourism in space, and people laying claim to territory. It's not science fiction, is it? It's near future stuff, Alice.
Yes, this is what people are talking about. So there's a huge debate at the moment on the status of weapons in space. So the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which kind of, it's the roadmap for everything we do in space, is all about the peaceful uses of outer space. But all of those early satellites were, in fact, military satellites. Defence has always been driving what's happening in space, and you know, it's no different now. And the US Defense Force is looking at, you know, security issues around using the moon and cislunar space, the space around the moon. So while there's a prohibition against putting nuclear weapons in space or on the moon, like, weapons aren't always just a gun. Sometimes they're sort of contextual. Sometimes there's things you can use to attack your enemy that aren't like a bomb or a gun. And this is a big debate at the moment, but I think it would be safe to say that defence interests will probably win out in the end. So even though we've got all of this treaty language about the peaceful uses of outer space, again, I think it's something that people on Earth just need to be watching out for, because it could change in a flash. Or someone, the first person to deploy some kind of weapon or carry out some kind of hostile act on the moon, you know, that's just going to change the whole story forever.
Let's come back to primary work for a moment and some of the wonderful stories attached to it. Some space junk isn't just in near orbit, some it's very distant. You find Russia's Venus landing missions particularly fascinating. Fill us in on some of what's there and why it's so interesting to you.
Venus tends to get forgotten about. Everybody's so fixated on Mars, and I'm going to be honest here and say I find Mars a boring planet. Sorry to all the Martian fans out there. But Venus is fascinating. It's fascinating because it's often called Earth's twin sister. Similar sizes, sort of similar distances from the sun, but Venus turned into this, you know, huge runaway greenhouse inferno, and we stayed nice and cool and green. And in the early days of the space race, Russia was trying to get everywhere. So it was going to the moon, it was sending things to Mars, and it sent a whole lot of surface landing missions to Venus. And these landing craft, to me, are quite amazing. They sort of look a little bit like Daleks. They kind of have a slightly sinister appearance, I guess. But they, after launching a whole series which never made it to the surface because people just didn't know much about Venus in those days, it's got such a thick cloud cover that knowing what it was like on the surface was really difficult. By about the ninth or tenth of these landing missions, they finally got some spacecraft to land on the surface and send pictures back. And these are extraordinary pictures of the surface of another planet that we can't see usually because of the clouds. And these spacecrafts had to be so strong. So they were made out of titanium because the surface temperature on Venus is about 450 degrees Celsius. And their camera eyes were made out of diamonds and sapphires, which I find, you know, quite evocative and, you know, almost romantic in a way. And then they've been abandoned because nobody's gone to the surface of Venus since 1985. And this is like a cultural record of human scientific interest in Venus. And I don't know, I just think of these spacecraft kind of all alone out there, just holding a silent vigil until someone comes back to get them.
I'm just having a flashback freak out to the fact that there actually are Daleks out there on another planet somewhere that might one day come back. I'm just going to get my anxiety under control.
What a joy
Doctor Who was. Just finally, New Zealand becoming more involved in space exploration. We're part of a satellite launch just a couple of weeks ago, a part of a joint exercise aboard SpaceX's Transporter rideshare mission. Interesting, the Uber of outer space. What's the significance of New Zealand having its own satellite, Alice?
Look, I'm a huge fan of the New Zealand space program, and if any of my mates from the University of Auckland space team are listening, g'day everyone. So New Zealand has done some really impressive things in space. So this is a satellite that, as you said, was just launched a couple of weeks ago. Its aim is to monitor methane emissions on Earth, because methane is starting to look like a pretty big greenhouse gas problem. It's a satellite that's mostly funded by an NGO, the Environmental Defence Fund, and New Zealand is collaborating with a bunch of other organisations, including Harvard University, and the Mission Control is run out of Auckland. And this is a piece of New Zealand's future space heritage. So it's unclear how long it will be up there, but what it shows, I guess, is something about how New Zealand sees itself as a global space citizen, building on a long and proud tradition there. It's a very active contribution to getting data we need to manage Earth's environment better. And it's a physical object, an artifact that represents New Zealand in space. So only just launched, but I'll be keeping my eye on it as well. to see what New Zealand's own archaeological record in space is going to start to look like as you continue to go forward and do great things.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for your time. That is Alice Gorman. She is Vice Chair of the Global Expert Group on Sustainable Lunar Activities, an expert member of the International Scientific Community for Aerospace Heritage, and she is a pioneer of space archaeology.